Hello, I am Greg Livingston here with Jesse Ozog speaking about his game Dr. Space Zoo. And Jesse, just for people who aren't familiar with Dr. Space Zoo, could you explain the general gist of it?
Sure. Thanks for having me on here. Dr. Space Zoo it's a twin stick shoot 'em up. It's a little different from normal twin sticks where you just blow up everything that moves. And Dr. Space Zoo, you really want to be more precise. You want to go in, save good animals from these space zoos, and blow up the space zoo defenses that are trying to stop you from doing that. So I like to really call it a precision twin stick because you got to really be careful in what you're doing there.
Right. And not only can you blow up animals by mistake, but you can also open up walls and let loose enemies that might otherwise not get to you.
Yeah, there's a ton of collateral damage in the game. It's pretty much built around collateral damage. I've tried to make everything on the inside of these space zoos destructible. Pretty much the main destructible thing you'll find in there right now are fountains. So there'll be a lot of decorative fountains that you can kind of work your way through. They're very useful in the later game for cover. When you kind of get swarmed, you can dive your way into a fountain and kind of funnel the enemies into you until they kind of break through there as well.
So each level has a required animal that you have to collect before you can exit the level. And as you were just mentioning, walls can also block bullets. So level design plays an important part in how players and enemies confront one another because the player finds themselves navigating through this level and they're taking cover and they're searching for an animal. So on one hand, the player is exploring a new environment, trying to get used to where things are placed, and at the same time, they're fighting enemies and trying to take cover. And I wanted to ask how you balance the level design between those two purposes, between the exploration and the combat.
That's a pretty involved question here, so let me get started at the beginning here. So, Dr. Space Zoo is built around five different missions for, let's say, the story and action mode. The first mission is going to be taking place in our system, and the zoos are kind of, they're not really too crazy. They just got like some round rooms, some square rooms, and they're all kind of connected in a pretty easy way. There's not a lot of different paths to get through them, and they're a little bit simpler. The second mission is designed to be taking place in an asteroid, so like all of them are going to be kind of rounder rooms, a little bit more organic feeling is what I'm going for with the second mission. The third mission is it's supposed to be like derelict space hulks, so they're old spaceships and parts that have just kind of been bolted together to make these zoos. So they're going to be more square, more placed on a grid structure. The fourth mission is the AI's mission, so they're trying to be a little bit more like how the AI would try to construct these missions. So they're going to have a different feel from the first three. The last one is the animal lab, so they're going to be kind of having their own feel as well for how I felt these labs should be. And as you go on, they obviously get bigger. So the first mission will have pretty small zoos. By the last mission, they're pretty large. So all this procedural generation, it's going to give you a different set of zoos every time you play through it. And that's really the only way I've been able to kind of sanely play this game for like the last 2 years, is the fact that the procedural generation is like, it always surprises me. So like on one hand you have like kind of the form that the level takes, and that's what the procedural generation does first. It says, all right, given the rules for generating this one, how am I going to lay out my rooms? How am I going to connect them? How are they all together? Kind of how's the feel for this the zoo going to look? So once we get all the levels laid out and kind of set and like how they're going to be spatially, the next task I'm going to go through is go and figure out like, all right, where do I want to place the target animal now? So I want to look for maybe not the farthest zoo, but like based on some criteria for like connectedness of the room, like how the parent rooms are, and like kind of how they are on the chain of getting from like that room to the start. Where I want to place the animal is going to be on like, usually it's the, let's say farthest, but that's not really a good term. It's going to be the one that you're going to go through a certain variety of rooms. You're going to go through some hubs, some spokes, just to try to get between you and the animal. So you have to traverse a decent part of the zoo. It's not necessarily going to be a linear path through there. I tried to connect these things in a way that gave multiple paths through. You might, on some of the larger ones, explore a good chunk or a good branch of the zoo, and you can find your target animal, but it might be connected on a different path. So you can see it, you have an idea where you need to go. But you might need to backtrack a little bit and kind of find a different path to find your animal. Once you have kind of figured out where the animal is and like the paths that you can take to get to that animal, then what I'm going to do is I'm going to do some calculations to try to determine the overall flow of it. So like flow is very important for when you're doing any kind of level design because you want to have it challenging, give a couple beats to the player where they can you know, kind of regain their comfort and then like challenge them a little bit harder. So I want to try to keep the player engaged from like the start to the finish here. So we're going to, the start of the zoo will be a little bit easier. They'll go a little bit deeper and it's going to get a little bit more difficult. They might hit a room that doesn't have any enemies to kind of give a safe spot to retreat to or to kind of, you know, regain their composure as they go through this. The last part with the target animal is going to be most likely the most difficult part of the zoo. So they fight this level difficulty gradient from the front to the back. And then once they get the animal, if I would have done nothing else, they have a pretty much a clear path to get out. But as you said, you're playing it, you notice that, I don't know if you noticed, but once you grab the target animal, then the secondary line of defenses are going to come out. So there's like some hangars that were maybe closed when you're traversing the first part of the level. But once you get that target animal, it's going to activate those and it's going to set what I call the resistance flow. So when you get that, there's not going to be like an easy path to get out now. Now you have a bunch of new stuff that has spawned that's going to try to, you know, swarm you to prevent you from getting out with this animal. So it's really balancing all that together to try to come up with procedural ways of making these levels that are interesting every time you play them. I spent a lot of time trying to tune the procedural generation just to make sure that it plays well and that it's not given like maybe easy levels when it should be a very hard level.
Make sure you don't place the target animal right at the start.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, there should never really be a case where the target animal is at the start. You're going to have a lot of the fodder animals, just the ones that you should be saving anyways, because you're going to get the upgrades and the temporary power ups that they drop. But really, it's you're trying to find that animal that should be somewhere. You'll have traversed like, you know, the difficult stretch of the zoo to find that animal and then fight your way back out. So that's really what I'm trying to go for with all the level design here. And I don't really know if I answered your question. I feel like I just kind of rambled on about procedural generation.
So it sounds like deep in that algorithm, you have different classes of rooms. You mentioned like hubs and spooks.
Basically, it's the rooms are connected in a graph. So if you put these, they have a relationship of a parent to child relationship. So you have the hub is what I call the parent node. So it might have a couple of child nodes off it. But when I generate these, I kind of generate them in a parent-child relationship. So I'll like generate some the parent node, then a couple children off of it. Those children might get additional children. So you get this kind of a normal tree-based graph, but that's not very interesting as far as levels go. So I when I'm doing the generation phase, once I get everything laid out, then I run a secondary connection phase that'll try to connect them in more interesting ways than just having like a straight tree structure. So I might do it by proximity, by difficulty, by a couple other factors in the generation to try to connect them in hopefully interesting, meaningful ways that, you know, are going to challenge the player.
Right. I just got to the fifth world tonight, and noticed there's some interesting designs where you'll get hubs coming off of paths through the levels, and I got stuck on this one particular mission where sometimes the target animal would be up in the north, and sometimes they would be down in the south, but like it's generally the same, around the same depth into the level.
Right, so as far as that goes, like one of my other goals is like when you're playing the seeds, you're going to have the same set of levels. They're going to look visually the same. But one of the things, like when you go to replay that level, let's say you get to your target animal and you fail, you pretty much know the short path to that animal now. So in order to kind of prevent the player from just, you know, finding the animal dying and then the next time, you know, just taking that shortest path to the animal, I'm still doing some randomization of not really deterministic randomization. I'm doing like pure randomization of where the actual target animal is placed. So it's like I might have, like in the larger levels, I might have four candidate rooms where a target animal might spawn. And then when the level is loaded, it determines which of those four rooms it's actually going to stick the target in. So that way, when you fail and go to replay it again, you're still being freshly challenged because the target animal might not be in that same room as in the last time. So
right.
You're still going to be rewarded for more fully exploring the level as opposed to just taking that shortest path from, you know, A to B and then back to the exit.
So moving on to more about combat, enemies will have a variety of bullet spreads and some even have giant lasers that like to suck away your health. And the player has a wide selection of guns too. How did you balance these two weapon sets against each other?
I mean, you're pretty deep in the game. I don't have the full story added into it yet. I'm going to save that for pretty much right before the final release out of Early Access. But the story is that these zoos, you know, were created by Dr. Space Zoo. So him and Winston have kind of gone in and made all the technology for this. So their weapons are going to be kind of similar to the player weapons. Like, you're going to see some of their homing bullets. The player doesn't have, like, some of the more slowing bullets yet. but they all have pretty much the same like bullet technology, let's say. So they're going to have different patterns, different homing, you know, spreads, and also lasers as well. Everything's got to have a laser in the last phase when it's trying to die. So I'm sure that's been surprising, or maybe after the third time it's not surprising that the boss is going to try to blast you with a laser when it's low on health. But yes, I mean, everything's, you know, same technology essentially has gone into what the player ship is versus what all the defenses in the zoo are. So I've tried to give everything kind of a, like there's a, I don't know, there's what, like maybe, I'm just going off the top of my head, like maybe 15 different enemy types, let's say, in here. So you have like the base enemy is that little, you know, metallic guy that kind of moves slow and just shoots the spray and pray circle around it. The second one would be that guy that shoots the homing bullets that kind of leads with the red homing bullets that try to immobilize you so it could come in and ram you, and then it flees off a little bit and then comes back and does it again.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you have like kind of the different, like all these enemies are going to pretty much behave the same right now. One of the things on my plate for later on is to kind of, you know, as you go through, maybe that these base enemies get an extra skill as well. I don't know if that's really going to work yet. It's something I have to look at a little bit more, but you have the different base enemies that are going to, like, you have the fast-firing guys that kind of act like the mobile turrets. But really, I try to balance, like, the player weapons. You kind of get a slow progression of weapons. Like, you'll have, by the end of the first mission, you hopefully have the shotgun if you've been saving a lot of animals. You might start getting, like, some of the stronger homing bullets. Do you have the drunken homing bullets in where you're playing right now?
No, I just got the circle homing.
Okay, so you're a bit off. Like, the way I've tried to tune this is if you're saving, like, let's say, like, the majority of the animals in these zoos, that by the fifth mission you should have drunken homing. I did see a couple people do full playthroughs that they didn't really get that until, like, midway through mission 5, so maybe that curve is a little off right now.
In my personal experience, I played through the first two worlds and did absolutely terribly. So I restarted and played those pretty solid, but once I get up to mission 3, things get, I feel like the level size increases dramatically and there's a lot more going on screen, so personally I had to be a lot more conservative, and that went forward into less experience.
All right, yeah, I mean, I can see that. There's definitely a lot of tuning that needs to be made as far as the difficulty curve. And that's one of the great things of like bringing it to shows like Gamescape is I get to see people play through and I could kind of take mental notes of like where they are in the power curve, like what weapon upgrades they've been choosing. You know, are they dumping everything into acceleration and putting nothing into defense and weapon damage? It's just like trying to see like, why did you put your first 4 points in pickup range? Was that something you wanted to do? but just like kind of seeing the interesting choices they make, and then like after they've made them and stopped playing and be like, well, can you tell me why you thought this is a good way of going through. So, I mean, there's a little bit of power curve stuff I need to kind of, I definitely need to readdress, but I've got one more system I need to work on before I can really give that a solid pass and hope that it'll be like the final power curve chance. Hmm. But definitely I'm gathering a lot of analytics on this stuff, and that's, you know, something that maybe I agree that the third or fourth mission starts to get a little hectic. But yeah, I mean, it's pretty close to where it should be. You're playing story mode or action mode?
Oh, this is story mode.
Okay. So I would like to say, if anything, story mode is probably a bit overtuned because it's indicated to be easy, I believe. And I don't know that by the fifth mission that is easy anymore or even by the fourth. Action mode, I feel, is probably a little bit more balanced for like where I want it to be in difficulty. And definitely permadeath feels pretty spot on for like the challenge I want it to be. But I think story mode is going to get tuned down a little bit more before final.
Okay.
But definitely, as far as like the level size go, they have different constraints as far as how big or tall or wide the level is going to be. I believe mission 3 is, I want to say that's more of a square. Like, I think mission 2 might be more, the levels are more vertically centered, so they're going to be taller than they are wider. I believe mission 3 might kind of square that up again, and I think 4 and 5 are more rectangular as far as they're wider overall than they are tall. That's definitely presented a couple challenges. Like, I don't know how far you played at Gamescape, but the first day I had a bug where none of the boss rooms generated right on the rectangular levels, because I went in with the assumption of making these boss rooms that they would be kind of square shapes. I could put like big circular boss rooms in there.
Yeah.
And it just didn't work that first day at Gamescape. Like, a couple of people got through, and I was like, oh, I guess I got some work to do tonight, because I had to, hotfix some of that stuff, like, you know, after showing all day. And that's always fun and kind of nerve-wracking, because I can't give it, like, the good couple of days of testing that it got before the show. But there's definitely a lot of consideration for as far as level size and, like, how to balance, like, the overall size of the level, like, how many rooms are generating altogether. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely interesting that you told me that you don't have drunken homing by fifth mission. That should definitely be, like, one of the key tools in your toolbox there. Like, that and the shotgun are probably the most powerful, like, late-game weapons that you're going to have.
It is interesting how the abilities are, I think, pretty well balanced, in that the first time I played through, I dumped everything into power, because it just seemed like that would be objectively the most useful. And then I die in two hits, and I can't dodge anything. And right. So, for the most part, the level-up system works pretty well in that you have to think about what you actually need to play through.
Yeah, that's one of the things if you do... Because I try to play it different ways. Like, I try to play a game where I'm just doing only firing rate and weapon damage, and I'm doing nothing in defense. That you can kind of work through on, like, the levels, as far as you just don't advance as fast, like, you don't tear through the levels quickly. You kind of clear room by room and maybe retreat to a safe spot, like, once you clear it out. Once you get a little bit more defense, you could charge in a little bit faster, and just maybe, instead of clearing one room, you might clear two or three at a time. The only place that starts to fall apart is on some of the boss fights that do have, you know, a lot of just, I guess what I'd call, like, noise damage, or, like, the base damage they're doing from whatever their base pattern attack is, that you're just kind of, like, the drill bot when he does the spin with the circle, where he's just kind of raining like a spiral of red bullets around him. Like, yeah. That's not something you could really dodge. You're just going to have to eat that. The thing you're going to want to dodge on that is obviously the laser. Once you kind of get the dance of, you know, I need to kind of just be in a safe spot to eat this red damage, and then, you know, once he turns around and charges, I need to be able to dodge that laser blast. I mean, a certain amount of defense power-up is going to be able to mitigate that. Like, if you just dumped everything into weapon damage, it would just be a matter of hiding during that phase where, like, if you had more defense, you'd just eat it. So, I mean, it kind of alters the playstyle enough, but I think it can be viable to do it without defense. It just becomes super difficult. So I think, like, one of the challenges might be defeat the game without putting a single point into defense. That might be, like, one of those, you know, kind of crazy achievements that I'd put in later on. But I don't know that it's doable. I usually put at least one point in there. But it'd be interesting to kind of see, like how people challenge themselves, like, once the game is out and all the systems are, you know, solidified and done.
Yeah, with some of the bosses, those bullet patterns get so crazy. So it is interesting to hear that you're sort of anticipating people to not necessarily dodge every single thing, but more so to take damage intelligently.
Right. It's kind of based on a tank model. So, I mean, it's like, do you want to be more DPS or more tank, I guess, is, you know, kind of use the MMO thing here.
Right.
Yeah, I've definitely decided it's not like a normal shoot 'em up where you take one hit and you're dead and you got a tiny hitbox. I mean, I don't think that would really work at all in this. I mean, you definitely need that health meter. And that's one of the reasons I, like, when I'm fighting bosses, I don't know if you've noticed, but there's usually like a room or two of just loose animals that are kind of hanging out in the boss room. One of the, like, main tactics I do on that is I leave those alone until I need them. So, I mean, it's always, like, kind of a good thing. Like, if I'm fighting this boss and I take too much damage, I could always retreat back, you know, save those animals, heal up a little bit, maybe get a helpful power-up, and then, you know, go back in on the boss. So it's, I mean, there's definitely a couple strategies as far as, like, animal collecting goes.
Yeah. Honestly, I like just kiting the boss into those rooms, because then he's away from all the enemies that keep spawning in.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I'm really on the fence of, because the boss rooms, like, when I'm doing the generation form, so you fought the third boss, the octopus, with all the trash?
Yeah.
So the way that room is supposed to work is, it's this big circle, it's got a couple pillars for line of sight stuff, but it's got those animal converters that suck the animals in and make enemies.
Yeah.
It's not making, like, high-level enemies, it's just making, like, the first two trash mobs, so the guys that shoot the circles, and I think it might make a couple of the ramming guys. But that whole function there is to make trash. So when you kill these base level enemies, you're making trash. The octopus is sucking that trash in and making more defensive plates. So by taking that octopus away from the trash source, you definitely neuter its ability to make more defensive plates. So that boss fight is all about clearing the surroundings, and then once it's clear, you can really burn down the octopus. But by kind of kiting him over to like maybe the first room that you come in at, there's not really a lot of source for it to make trash. So it's definitely, like, once you burn through the plates, it's going to be, you know, pretty, I won't say easily defeated, but it's going to be more easily defeated than if you're fighting it in the proper room. So I'm still kind of debating on whether I want to lock the player in that room with the boss, or still continue to allow them to, you know, retreat back to those couple earlier rooms in the boss fight. So that's like one consideration I'm still trying to weigh. We'll see what it ends up being. Right now, I like the idea that they can use the environment to lure the boss in. Definitely for some of the, I don't know how far you are in the fifth mission, but there's two boss fights there. Oh. And those rooms are definitely pretty pivotal in as far as any kiting methods go. So I don't know. We'll see. I have to see a bunch of people play it and kind of, you know, get a better feel for what I'm going to finally do on that.
Okay. As players go through each level, they can carefully save each animal, or they can go straight for their required species and get right out. Right. And along the way, the players can choose to open each pen or just the necessary ones. So what you have there is kind of a skill floor and a skill ceiling. The skill floor being just get what's necessary and get out, and the skill ceiling being make sure you get everything, make sure you don't kill anything, and kill every single enemy that spawns in along the way. And so how far apart would you say are the skill floor and the ceiling?
So if you went in and did the minimum, so let's say you go in, you don't save any animals at all, you find the target animal and you fight your way back out without trying to save any animals at all, that's going to be super challenging because all of your upgrades are based on how many animals you've saved along the way. So by saving animals and killing enemies, you're going to get, I don't know if you've seen the power-up screen, you're going to get what I've termed, you know, experience points. Animals are going to give you the biggest source of experience points. So, and it definitely is going to make it more challenge, like significantly more challenging if you decide to not save any animals. If you do save all the animals, I think it's going to make the earlier game a lot easier because you're going to get some pretty rapid upgrades. Like that first mission, you should, like, if you went and saved all the animals, you're going to get, I think, like 4 or 5 upgrades by the time you hit the first boss. If you didn't really save any, you're going to maybe have 1. So, I mean, that first boss is going to be like pretty ultra challenging without having, you know, saved any animals. So it's really, at its core, Dr. Space is also a score rush game. So by saving animals, have you noticed the chain multiplier? Have you kind of figured out how that works?
Yeah, I saw that chain up in the corner, but I have not looked into how to actually work it yet.
So the chain multiplier works by every animal you save, your chain's going to go up by 1. So every enemy you kill, it's also going to go up by 1. So as soon as you shoot an animal, it's going to reset back to 1. And what that chain does is, it's number 1, it's your score multiplier. Number 2 is it's giving you a passive benefit to all of your base stats. So when you have chain 50, you're going to be taking less damage, doing more damage, firing faster, moving faster, having a larger pickup range than you would at chain 1. So when you have like 100 chain and you shoot an animal, it's kind of painful because you can, like, there's actually you can see the damage difference in like what you're doing per tick. Like the laser, maybe it's doing 50 as opposed to like 40. So, I mean, there's definitely a sizable difference in if you could build that chain. And some of the people I've seen stream it that go in, their tactic is they go in, like, clear the room of animals and then fight whatever was in there. So they're pretty much taking the collateral damage element out by not engaging the enemy until all the animals are saved.
Right.
And they get, I've seen, you know, some pretty large chains get up with that. And it's definitely given them some good benefit. But I feel like I've kind of wandered away from your skill floor and ceiling question here. But yeah, I mean, if you're not saving any animals, it's definitely going to take a lot more player skill to be successful. If you do save a bunch of animals, maybe that eases up the player skill requirement by some. So, I mean, it's kind of in the name of the title, so I want them to do that and to kind of ease it up. It would definitely be more of a challenge to ignore the animal element altogether.
Right. I guess what you have there is a short term and a long term, where in the short term, by saving fewer animals, you encounter fewer enemies, but in the long term, by saving fewer animals, you have a lower multiplier and you have less experience points.
Right, and that's really it. I mean, I think if you can, you know, fight your way to the target animal, I think you're well and able to full clear that zoo if you're so inclined. I think it's when you start getting into some of the later ones that are definitely more hectic. Let's say you were purposely ignoring some cages and leaving some animals in there. All the debris is designed so as soon as it touches a cage, it's going to instantly shatter that cage and hopefully chain react and like maybe shatter like another cage or two after that.
Yeah.
So really that's like in order to try to do the minimum, you would have to be very careful of leading all enemies kind of a back to whatever your safe area is, dealing with them there, and then proceeding forward. So it definitely would probably slow down progress. It'd be an interesting way to play the game. I don't know that I've ever seen somebody pretty much just ignore the saving most of the animals aspect.
Avoiding the animals.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting to see that. I mean, that would definitely be an interesting mode to witness.
That also does explain why, you know, sometimes when I fight a boss, I leave more animals than I should have for last, and then collecting all the animals, I notice I'm getting a bazillion points.
Right, yeah, I mean, your chain's really going up. And one of the things I don't really, like the boss rooms, I think some of them are currently generating with too many animals. So like after you kill the boss and like, you know, you've had a super hectic boss fight, one of the things that kind of bugs me is that, you know, when you kill this boss and then like all the big barriers go down. So you might have like 10, 15 rooms worth of animals just to kind of go from like room to room to collect. I definitely want to try to prune those so there's definitely not as much cleanup work after killing the boss as far as saving the animals. Like you don't want to, you know, be penalized for leaving all these animals behind. So I want to just kind of keep that, you know, like once they struggle through a hard boss fight, I want them to kind of, you know, exit on a high, not a, oh, well, now I have to go spend a minute collecting all these animals.
Time to do the cleanup.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, and I feel bad for whatever's got to come to these zoos afterwards to make them presentable again. Because there's this gore and stuff everywhere.
Ugh. How did you determine the spawn rate on enemies?
So that's just been something that's just a lot of playtesting. So as far as, there's a couple of different ways that enemies are spawned in. So when you load up a zoo, talking about that difficulty flow that I mentioned earlier, all the things that are above ground are placed at that moment. So all the cages are going to have their, you know, like 1 to 5 enemies. It might have a couple turrets in there. There might be a couple spawners. And really, the spawners are the ones that are going to spawn out, you know, whatever enemy it's configured to do, like every 15 or 30 seconds, whatever it's configured to do.
And those are those, like, panels in the floor that's red and white stripes?
Yeah, the little doors that open up and then pop out whatever's there. So there's a couple of different kind of variables as far as that goes. In the procedural generation, I have large tables as far as, like, you know, based on difficulty, connectedness, and a bunch of other parameters. How should this room be configured? Like, how many enemies should be present when you initially encounter it, and how many will kind of spawn out as you're fighting through that room? So, like, once the player gets within range of these things, if once they activate, the spawners will activate and then pump a couple extra enemies into the room during the course of that fight. So just trying to balance all that has just been a lot of playtesting. I play this game for hours and hours, and if I come across one that doesn't feel right, or maybe it's too difficult for what it should be, or maybe it's not difficult enough, I'll go in and look at those tables and say, you know, would trading out you know, one of the ramming enemies for, you know, a spawner of the sentries, the base enemy type that shoots the circles, would that make that feel a little better, or how would that play? And then I might go back in and play that seed again and say, you know, is this a positive change, you know, for this one instance? And then it'd just be a matter of me playing a whole bunch of different ones and saying, all right, well, how does this feel overall? So it's just a ton of playtesting and a ton of tables that kind of map all this magic together.
Okay.
They're very scary to have to alter those tables because it alters the core of the game pretty easily.
And that gets back to what you were talking about with flow earlier as well.
Right.
Giving the levels those structures where the player goes from less intense areas to more intense and back again.
Right. It's key to have those gaps. I've seen some people that just kind of Rambo their way in through the whole thing, so they're not really seeing those gaps at all because they still have a bunch of hate trailing, you know, both behind them and in front of them. So they don't really get the good beat, but hopefully that gives them a safe room to come back to. But most of the time, Ramboing the later levels doesn't really work out that well.
Yeah, enemies will stay right on top of you.
Yeah, they're definitely, the sentries move pretty slow, but the ones that are going to get you are the ramming enemies, the ones that shoot the red homing bullets. Because once you get, like, two or three of those on you, you're pretty immobilized, and then, you know, the rest of the crush is going to get you.
Yeah. Dr. Spacesu also has an eye for graphical flourishes. There's giant explosions, you have shaking screens, and glowy bullets. And I was wondering how you maintained visual clarity so that the player isn't overwhelmed with all these graphical effects.
So my main design goal with this, as far as the visual design goes, I'm trying to make like a modern take on a retro shoot 'em up. So that means taking like old school pixel art and just adding all these different modern shader effects to kind of make everything really sparkle and pop. So all the explosions are going to be keyed off of, like, the only thing that's going to use the color white in the game is something that explodes or is meant to sparkle. So like all the particle effects are going to be white. Some of the walls might have white, but like none of the enemies are really going to be using white, or none of the tiles, or none of the players. It's all just based on something that needs to be like visually intense to communicate explosions or movement or destruction is going to be using that white color, and that's going to really key off of all of the shaders and kind of bring it all together to make it visually. I'm trying to be like right on the line of visually overwhelming. Is kind of the goal I'm going for. So, and there's a lot of sparkles, there's a lot of glow, there's a lot of explosions in Screen Shake. Screen Shake is one of those things that I'm still, right now I think it's in a pretty good spot. Of like in the last couple Steam patches, I've tuned it down just a tiny bit, but it's really just trying to see like when I'm playing these later levels and a lot of stuff is exploding, there's a lot of movement, can I still, number one, find where I'm at in the mess and find what I'm aiming at and trying to save? So I'm really trying to get it to like right at that edge of when it's at its most frantic, can the player still kind of discern where they are? And I think I'm pretty close to being there. I might have to maybe dial back the Screen Shake just a tiny bit more, but I'm pretty happy with how it goes right now. The other thing is like for co-op, did you play co-op when you were at Gamescape? Or
no, I didn't have the chance.
So it does like 1-4 player co-op, and it's kind of like a gauntlet style. We're all on the same screen. So when you start adding in like 4 people doing their own thing, blowing things up, it became like super like visually overwhelming. So for co-op, the Screen Shake and a lot of that is tuned down. It's definitely got its own settings for internal settings that kind of scale everything down, just because I expect there to be 2 to 3 times the amount of explosions based on how many players are in there, at a time. So it's in a pretty good spot as far as co-op goes. That's definitely the hardest thing for me to test, and that's why it's important to kind of take co-op to shows, just to say, when I've got a bunch of people playing it, can they still kind of discern where they are?
Right.
Can they be successful? Is it, am I pretty close to being overwhelmed with the amount of stuff on the screen? So it's definitely a balancing act of, how do I feel personally? I feel like I'm starting to become a little desensitized to the amount of sparkles on the screen, but just kind of watching like somebody that's never seen it before. That's really the key for like, how do they initially react to it? Like, can they, number one, they'll probably go up and blow up all the animals in the tutorial level and then be like, oh, I get it now. But like once they kind of like get into like the more difficult, like maybe like halfway through the first mission when things are starting to get a little intense, like, are they still coping with it, and, have they kind of wrapped their head around, like, all the visual noise that's going on with what they have to do. So, bringing it to shows is very important for tuning all that. But that's something that's still ongoing, but I feel like it's pretty close to where it needs to be right now.
It's interesting that you bring up Gauntlet. I guess instead of shooting food, you're shooting animals.
Yeah, exactly. Player shot the animal. Yeah, I mean, because like in the first, I think the very first mission and boss missions as well, once you kill the boss, the target animal is always going to, there's going to be one that is shielded, so you can't kill it. You can't fail once you have killed the boss unless a turret takes you out. And same thing in the tutorial. That really fixed my problem of people going in and just killing all the animals and asking why they failed. So having that one animal shielded, kind of like once they murder all the animals and I call them a monster, if they're in front of me, they then rescue that one animal and be like, oh, this is different from normal shoot 'em ups. I have to actually save these things that I guess are now animals. So yeah, I mean, it's I try to, like in the boss levels, I try to make it so they can't fail once they defeat the boss in the room. But yeah, shooting the animals, there's definitely a ton of collateral damage. And when you see people playing co-op, there's always that one person that is just gung-ho and blowing up every room that they go into. And it's funny to see how like the other people in their party kind of be like, well, you know, my buddy here is just going in and lighting up these rooms, so I got to get in there and save the animals I need to save before he gets there. Which is, it's always kind of interesting to see like how that dynamic comes out of like, you know, who's following whom, who's kind of in control of like where they're going, and then is there that one person that's totally rogue and just blowing everything up that moves, and I don't know, co-op's fun to watch for that purpose.
Nice. And finally, I wanted to ask, when it comes to game design, which would you consider the most important? The game itself, the intention of the developer, or the experience of the player?
As far as the game design goes, it's got to enable the player to have a good experience. So, and I've talked about this for the last however long we've been talking. So like all these things that I'm doing are to enable the player to hopefully maintain that flow state when they're playing and to be visually overwhelmed, but like not too much. So all these tuning changes and balancing and flow changes and procedural generation stuff is all to try to enable the player to be challenged throughout, to hopefully not be bored and enjoy the game. So really, I would say it's a experience of the player is what's going to drive all this.
All right. Is there anything you would like to bring up or any websites to share?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is out on Steam Early Access right now. You can go to drspacesu.com to find how to find it on Steam and itch.io if you use that as well. As far as release, I'm perpetually 6 months away from being done with it. I feel like I'm getting closer to being done in that 6 months. I would love to launch this year, but I just have a feeling it's going to be early next year. But I'm definitely, I try to patch like every week or two on Steam. I put a patch up there, so it's active development on that. As far as playing it, I've been playing this game for 2 years. I still find it fun. Permadeath is really my my mode of choice right now. That's the one that's the most tense, and I can't autopilot that one at all. I've got to pay attention the whole time, and you know, it's the one I'm playing the most right now, so I'm hoping that I can add a little bit more depth to that, you know, going forward. But yeah, man, I'm really happy with where it's at. I've got an awesome artist. A lot of the art is done by a fellow by the name of Khalif Steele. He's on Twitter, and he's awesome. But yeah, so it's like just the two of us working on this, and I hope to be done in 6 months with it, but I guess talk to me in 6 months and see if we are.
Best of luck. It definitely does, I mean, has the modes and polish of something that already feels like a finished product, so.
Well, good, yeah. I really didn't want to launch on Early Access until it was a place to where, like, I felt if I just stopped working on it altogether that it was still something that I could release and be proud of. So really the Early Access is just, you know, adding all the Steam stuff and a couple other bucket items that I wanted to add on there, and hopefully it's you know, it's done and, you know, happy, and it's fun to play when it's all done.
Nice. Well, thanks for talking with me.
Yeah, it was a pleasure speaking with you, Greg. I appreciate you taking time out of your night here to talk with me, and for definitely checking me out at Gamescape.
Yeah,